Yes, north, south, east, or west. It's Maxwell House wherever you go. Famous for finer flavor, this delicious coffee is good to the last drop. For the best in coffee drinking pleasure, always ask for Maxwell House.
It's the roar of the presses. Working day and night in the north, south, east, and west of our nation, these daily presses pour out over 48 million newspapers. And behind these millions of headlines are the country's ace reporters, men and women who bring you the inside story. Tonight, the makers of Maxwell House Coffee bring you America's Press Conference of the Air, Meet the Press, where you'll meet top newsmen in an unrehearsed, spontaneous press conference with one of the outstanding personalities in today's news, the Honorable James A. Farley. Ready for the conference are four of America's top newsmen who are here to ask the questions you would ask Mr. Farley. It's all done in the spirit of a free press and free television. Now, meet Mr. Lawrence Spivak. Mr. Spivak is the editor of the American Mercury magazine. And here is Mr. Murray Snyder, distinguished reporter with the New York Herald Tribune. Also noted among the gentlemen of the press is Mr. Larry Newman of the American Weekly. Another important newsman here tonight is Mr. Cecil B. Dixon of the Gannett newspapers. And here with us is radio's Miss Martha Roundtree, producer of Meet the Press. And here being introduced to the press is the Honorable James A. Farley. Mr. Farley is the former chairman of the Democratic National Committee and author of the book, Jim Farley's Story. As you know, it was Mr. Farley, the political traveling salesman, who helped to make Franklin D. Roosevelt president of the United States. And now, Miss Roundtree.
And now, who has the first question? Mr. Spivak.
Well, Mr. Farley, I'm going to ask you the most surprising question of the evening. What do you think of the election?
Well, as a partisan Democrat, I thought it was great. Great for the country and great for the party.
Were you surprised, though, at the results?
Frankly, I was. I thought that President Truman would get about 23 million votes. And from what I saw when I came back from Europe, and what I saw from the poll takers and the political writers I had an opportunity of talking with, I thought that Mr. Dewey would get approximately 23 million votes, and I thought Wallace might go to 2 million.
Well, you thought they'd both get, each would get 23 million votes?
No, I should have said Mr. Dewey, 25 million, I beg your
25,
pardon.
25, but you thought Dewey would be elected.
I thought he would have, I thought Dewey, based on what I saw and heard, would have more electoral votes, although I figured that the popular vote would be that close.
Now, what do you think was largely responsible for the upset?
Well, basically, I think there was a large Democratic vote, a lot of people in the United States that were still grateful to the Democratic Party for the four administrations that have passed, starting in 1933. I think people that were helped as a result of housing legislation, people who were helped by Social Security, many of the people, millions of people that have been helped by some agency of the federal government showed their appreciation. I think in the final analysis, however, the result was brought about by the strong effort put forth by labor, organized and unorganized, and there isn't any doubt that the farmers in the final analysis gave a large support. But far and beyond and above that, Larry, I felt that a great many people didn't like Dewey. They didn't like the campaign he conducted. He was all things to all men. He threw around a lot of generalities and platitudes, whereas President Truman, whether they liked him or not, they knew exactly where he stood on every important question. And in the final analysis, I think they got a little bit afraid of Dewey, and they went to Mr. Truman. I think a sufficient number did that in the last few weeks of the campaign.
Mr. Newman.
Mr. Farley, what do you think happened to those 4 to 6 million votes that you said Mr. Wallace was going to pull. Remember, we were on the program.
Yes, I said he'd get about 5 million, Larry, but before I went to Europe, I said that I thought it would drop down to 3 million and maybe a little under three. My opinion is this, that Wallace lost a tremendous amount of votes as a result of the Philadelphia Convention. They put the communistic tag on Wallace in that convention, which, as you know, was run in a large measure by people closely allied with the communistic cause. I think television, the pictures that were shown of the convention, a lot of people that were shown there who didn't appear to have too much sense, if I may use the expression. I think television more than anything else, and the communistic tinge. And then in the final analysis, the people who might want to vote for Wallace as a protest vote, they saw there was no chance for Wallace to get anywhere. And I think that, probably 75% of that vote went to Mr. Truman.
Mr. Dixon now.
Jim, Senator McGrath, the chairman of the Democratic National Committee, has threatened to punish the Southern Dixiecrats, and some of the other people. What do you think of that attitude at this time when the party is in power?
Well, now, Dick, I don't think you get anywhere punishing anybody. If I were in McGrath's place, I would do everything I could to reconcile the differences that exist now. The South has traditionally supported the Democratic Party. We've had these differences now. These differences should be adjusted so that President Truman, from the time Congress convenes, has a strong backing in the Senate and the House. And may I say in passing that I think Howard McGrath is entitled to a great deal of credit for the way he conducted the campaign. I can appreciate the problems of a national chairman. He took over at a time when the situation, frankly, was bad for the party. He presided over a convention where the situation wasn't too good because of the opposition of a lot of Democrats. And he's conducted himself excellently, and I think he and those associated with him in the National Committee are entitled to a lot of credit.
When do you think this change came for Mr. Truman?
Oh, I'm only guessing now. I didn't get back from Europe, Dick, until the 21st of October. It apparently took place before that. But finally, I think in the last 2 weeks of the campaign. The Daily News poll, it would appear to me, to be the first poll that caught it, because their poll was later than any of the others.
Mr. Snyder.
General, about 16 years ago, when you were national chairman...
That's a long time ago, too.
There was a very popular phrase applied to some Democrats who were not for Roosevelt before Chicago.
FRBC.
Yes, and if I'm not mistaken, they took it on the chin. Now, don't you... what kind of advice are you giving to Truman for people who weren't for Truman before Philadelphia?
Well, I think Mr. Truman and Howard McGrath can take care of that situation without any advice from me. I'm not talking now about the politician, so to speak. I'm talking about the complete overall picture. I think it's important to have unity in the country, Murray, and unity in the Congress. We're in rather an unusual situation in the world. And I think we should do everything we possibly can, the President and Howard McGrath, too, to get everybody united, because there's going to be important legislation not only of a national but an international character. The Marshall Plan will probably want to be kept on and maybe improved upon. And you're not going to get anywhere by having fights in the Congress, so we ought to try to patch that up.
General, do you think you can keep that unity if the President goes through this platform promise to enact civil rights legislation?
Well, let's presume upon the theory that it'll be worked out all right. I think it will be. I really do, Murray. I'm one of those optimistic fellows who thinks it will work out all right.
Are you one of the people, Mr. Farley, who thinks the Taft-Hartley bill should be repealed?
Well, I think that the Taft-Hartley bill probably has some features that should be amended. But a great many labor leaders that I talk to criticize the act, not in its entirety. Undoubtedly, there are some features of the Taft-Hartley bill that should be repealed. Now, I'm not familiar with the bill itself, to start picking out the different features. I think the bill could be repealed, so to speak, in a way that would be satisfactory to both labor and industry, if you will.
Well, the Democrats are really pledged to repeal it.
Yeah, apparently from their campaign.
Would you have put that in the platform? Had you had anything to do with it?
Well, it was in there.
Mr. Spivak.
Mr. Farley, I think the total of the Ohio vote is rather extraordinary, and I wonder whether you have any explanation for it. As I understand it, there were 300,000 less votes cast for Mr. Truman and Mr. Dewey than were cast for the governors who were running on the same ticket. And I wondered whether...
Well, the reason for that may be due to the fact that they had two ballots in Ohio. See, in New York State, we just had the machine, and they were both on the machine. In Ohio, you had a separate ballot for the presidential candidates and a separate ballot for the state ticket. Now, it may be possible, Larry, that the Democratic and Republican politicians or leaders, if you will, in those states, in that particular state, were more anxious to elect a governor than they were a president. And they may have bore down on the, be sure and you vote for the state, for the governor and for the state ticket. And maybe a great many on both sides didn't vote the presidential ballot. I think that probably had more to do with it than a desire upon the part of the electorate in Ohio not to vote for a presidential candidate.
Mr. Newman.
Mr. Farley, don't you think...
Call me Jim, Larry. Everybody does.
All right, Jim. In fact, in view of the fact that Mr. Truman is pledged to carry out his civil liberties fight, and the Southern senators are in senior positions where they're going to hold a lot of very important committee positions, I think he's in for a lot of trouble. Now, don't you...
Well, he's in for trouble. Of course, he can't help but be in for trouble. But I have a sort of a feeling, Larry, and you ask me why I have it, I can't give you the answer. But I have a sort of a feeling that if and when the Congress convenes, that there's going to be an approach there on the part of the President and probably those in Washington and in the Congress, too, to try to straighten out the situation so you'll have a united party. I think every effort should be made in that direction. And frankly, I think it can be done.
Mr. Dixon.
Jim, the stock market took a terrible walloping, about $5 billion in value since Mr. Truman was elected. Do you think that the lack of confidence is reflected by this selling splurge?
I wouldn't worry too much about Dick. Maybe a lot of people went in the market figuring that Mr. Dewey was going to be elected, and then when he wasn't, they tried to get out. I wouldn't worry too much about what happened to people who were in the stock market.
Well, one other question. Why did Mr. Truman get the farm vote, which is traditionally Republican in prosperous times?
Well, I think he got it for this reason. The Democrats have been in power for 16 years, and down through the years, at the time the Democrats came in power, you remember what the price of corn and wheat was. I remember in Kansas City market in 31, when I went through there for President Reuben, I think corn was 31 cents a bushel or something like that. Cotton was 5 or 6 or 7 cents. And from then on, the Democrats came in power. Subsidies were granted by the Congress under the direction of Mr. Roosevelt. And down through the years, the farmers have done very well under Democratic administration. Now, Stassen, as you recall, made a speech in Milwaukee and made some reference to subsidies. And I think it's the sort of a feeling oozed out, so to speak, around the country among the farmers who were doing pretty well that maybe if Dewey came in. And I think that they were shown that they were satisfied under a Democratic administration, and they feared what Dewey was going to do, because frankly, Dewey on that and every other question never took a definite stand, Dixon.
Well, what was the weakest point of Dewey's campaign?
Well, it was weak all around in my book. In other words, he was all things to all men. He had a sort of a smug attitude, which he always had, and I think that the American people finally, that percentage of the American people that decide victories, the difference between victories and defeats, that group, which was sufficient, left Dewey. I talked to dozens of people from the time I got home, Dixon, up until the polls closed, of people who were going to vote for Dewey, and they didn't want to do it. Now, the only argument they'd offer is that they want to change. That was the best argument they had to offer, and they were voting for Dewey with regret. Now, when people are voting for a fellow that way, it doesn't mean anything. Yeah, I mean, you have to feel enthusiastic or sincere when you're voting for a fellow. Now, if it was true in New York, it was true all over the country, in the North at least.
What was the key
just
to...
Just a moment, Mr. Dixon. We'll be back in just a moment.
Well, I want to say to you, Larry, I am not going to give any advice to the Republicans.
I mean, you might have some suggestions.
Now, I'm a firm believer in the two-party system, however, and I feel that the best thing for the country is to have the minority party strong. I said to Mark Sullivan, I shall never forget, in 1933 before the National Press Club, he wanted to know if I felt if the Republican Party should be strong. I said, yes, Mark, I would like to see it strong, but not too strong.
Mr. Spivak.
Jim, there are a lot of people in this country as a result of this election who feel we're going the way of England and that we may go socialistic. Now, what do you think?
In my judgment, that's never going to happen in the United States. We are not going like England. We're a different people. We have greater resources. We have greater... we have everything here that makes the country great, Larry, and I have no fear of this country going socialistic.
Well, you're a big businessman today, Jim. Do you think that big business and small business has anything to fear from this 81st Congress and from Truman?
No, I don't think they have anything to fear from the 81st Congress or from Truman either. I'm sure that the American people are going to realize that there are some changes that must be made in our system, and they're going to go along, and those changes will be made.
Well, you don't think, then, that we're coming back to an OPA and a rationing?
Well, I can't make any observations on that. I really don't know, but I'm not going to be disturbed about it. Really, I'm not. Well, I don't know that we're going to come back to it. Let me put it this way. We ought to do, in the legislation, we ought to do what's best for the American people generally. Now, that may be a general statement, but it's an honest statement. Now, I'd have to know more about what legislation was proposed and other factors in connection with it. The American people are going to always do the right thing, and I think the American people will go along with legislation that, if it can be pointed out, it's for the best interest of the American people generally, they'll accept it. And I feel that that big business and little business, they haven't anything to worry about with President Truman. He's an American with his feet on the ground. He's patriotic and he's sincere. And he probably just has two or three things definitely in mind. In the first place, try to make it possible for us to live in a peaceful world and try to do what is best for the American people in that kind of a situation.
Mr. Snyder.
How much do you think, Jim, the old love or respect or veneration for Roosevelt had to do with Truman's vote?
Well, there isn't any doubt that a great many people, I said in a statement I issued a week before election, that they referred to it as an iffy statement, as you recall. I said that if the people who were benefited and who supported the Roosevelt administration through those four terms, if they gave to Mr. Truman that support which he had earned, that he'd be elected. There isn't any doubt that there were millions of people benefited by the Roosevelt administration from 1933 on, and there isn't any doubt. And labor probably was a factor in that. Labor felt grateful to what had been done for what had been done for them by the Roosevelt administration. And they went along. There isn't any doubt that that was a carryover.
Well, General, if it was labor and if there's a leftward tendency that a lot of people have seen, do you think the country will accept your proposal that we resume complete diplomatic relations with Spain and give them help?
I don't know whether they will or not, but Murray, I think they should, and I'll tell you why. I'm a practical American who feels that what we should do now is what is best for America. Some people have criticized what I said about Spain. I believe that we should, through the United Nations, reopen negotiations with Spain. Now, we sit down and they accuse Franco of many things. My God, we're sitting down with Stalin and his representatives, and Lord knows they've done plenty to the world, and they're doing it now. They're preventing us from living in a peaceful world. Our country now doesn't permit people in Spain or their representatives to sit down on health conferences, on aviation conferences. There's one country in Europe, one country, that if anything happens, if Russia starts any trouble, that country will stand right at the Pyrenees, whatever army they have and whatever support they have, and they'll fight to the bitter end. And I don't think we should wait until that time happens. I think that we should proceed through regular channels to recognize Spain. We recognized Spain during the war. Carlton Hayes was there as our ambassador. And I think it can be truthfully said. In fact, I know. It was told to me on this trip by very responsible people in Europe that if it hadn't been for the fact that there was cooperation upon the part of the Franco government, that invasion in Africa might not have been possible.
Would we have gotten that cooperation if we hadn't been sending goods and materials to them?
I don't know, but we did. We certainly got cooperation. Now, I'm not at liberty to tell what I know, but I know that representatives of the American government during that period were in conference with representatives of that government, and they permitted. I don't know whether that's the proper word, but they knew what was going on, and we would never have been in Spanish waters without their knowledge and permission.
Mr. Spivak.
Well, Jim,
I'm very decided in my viewpoint on that, and I do hope that... I've talked to people who are closer to the picture than I, and I'm talking now only from one point of view. I think it's best for America, and I feel that the State Department or the people in the State Department that are stopping negotiations, if that's the way to put it, are just stupid, and they're doing an injustice to the America and to the American people and to the cause of peace.
Jim, a great number of us here feel that Franco is not good for Spain, and that if we do anything to strengthen his hand today, why, we'll reestablish his strength in Spain to a degree where he won't be able to...
Well, let me answer your question this way, Larry. Franco is going to remain in Spain, and I think it's about time that we stop picking rulers for foreign countries. We let them pick their own rulers. If that's what they want in Spain, they're entitled to have that. I want to repeat, we shouldn't be picking. We butted in, down in the Argentine, and the fact that Braden took the attitude he did, undoubtedly, was in large measure responsible for the re-election of Perón. I'm not going to make any comment as to whether that was the right or wrong thing for the Argentinians to do, but the fact remains that Perón said that himself, getting into the situation made certain his election. We shouldn't be picking rulers of other countries.
Now, but Jim, one other question. Just exactly what have we to gain by recognizing Franco again or resuming diplomatic relations? Certainly he's not going with the Russians in case of a war.
No,
he
under
has
no
anywhere
circumstance.
To go except with us.
Well, I know, but isn't it better if we get in trouble rather than moving over in there and taking possession, so to speak, and go in there on unfriendly people rather than make them friends of ours? Now, the Spanish people are friendly disposed toward the United States. And where are you going to make your fight from? You can't make it all from England.
No, but we had an occasion once before when we were at war, and all that Franco did was remain neutral. He certainly didn't come to our aid in spite of the fact that we gave him quite a number of
things. Well, I know, but I want to repeat. If he hadn't closed his eyes, the Allied invasion in Africa would not have been possible. And God only knows, Larry, how long the war would have been prolonged.
Well, Jim, how can you trust a fellow, for example, who took aid from Germany and Italy and then closed his eyes to anything that they wanted him to do and closed his eyes to what we wanted him to do?
Well, I'll answer your question by saying, look what we did with Stalin and look what he's done to us. Jim?
Mr. Dixon.
Is it true that England has recognized Spain? They have a trade treaty and they're doing a big trade?
Yes, I understand that France has recognized
it. All right, and we are supporting England, aren't we, with our post-war little
Indeed
leagues.
Indeed we are.
We're trying to rehabilitate them.
Now, as a matter of fact, let me put it this way, Dick.
It's farther from the English Channel across to England from Belgium than it is from Belgium down to Spain, where we might get a chance to have some protected bases in the event of war with Russia.
That's right.
And also, we would have a dominating position over the Mediterranean.
Now, let me say this to you. I'm not a diplomat, and I never will be a diplomat. I'm just speaking now as an American citizen concerned about the welfare of his country. And I think it's about time we talk to the British government, if you will, and talk to France, too, if you will. God knows we're extending all kinds of help to them. And I feel that the State Department should, in the proper language, and maybe the language befitting the occasion, Dick, explain to him why we think this is best for America, and they should go along with us. Now, there isn't any doubt in my mind, and I'm not privileged to speak, but I can say to you that I know that there's some pretty responsible people in England who are sympathetic to the viewpoint I express here. And I know there are people, responsible people in the State Department, who are of the same viewpoint.
At that point, who do you think would make a good successor to Secretary of State Marshall?
Well, it isn't for me to make any suggestions.
How about Omar Bradley?
Well, Omar Bradley, I'd only met the general once or twice, but everyone who has ever talked with me have said kind things. But I wouldn't want to go along on that, Dick. I don't think that military men are proper should be appointed to responsible positions of that kind. I'd rather see a businessman or a man grounded in life other than the military life. I'm opposed to military men having positions of that character. Now, that's a personal position, and it has no reflection on any individual in the military. I think it's a wrong policy.
Mr. Spivak.
And I'll tell you why I think it's a wrong policy. They're brought up under a system where they give and take orders, and they don't know what it is to compromise. I think a good, hard-boiled fellow who's fought his way up and understands the business of give and take is better than
that. I think you ought to look over Omar Bradley's speeches and something he's done, though. Well, I think it's unusual.
Well, I'm talking now in generally. I'm not speaking against the individual because I have a very wholesome respect for General Marshall as a person.
Jim, I'd like to get back to politics again for a moment anyhow. I've heard a good deal of recent talk about you, and many, many suggestions have been made that the best man to run for the governorship on the Democratic ticket would be Jim Farley. Now, can we nominate you today, or are you definitely out of...
Now, why do you want to bring up the question of politics when we're about Farley personally, when we're having such a pleasant discussion?
You just agreed that it was a good idea.
I know, but that's all academic now. Let's get this administration underway, and let's do what's best for the country, and let's worry about New York State in 1950. There's plenty of time to worry about that. Wow. All I can say in answer to that is this. If the Democratic leaders and the Democratic organization in New York State use good judgment and conduct themselves well in the coming days ahead, I feel certain that an organization can be put together here, and they can select nominees that will, in my judgment, bring the Democratic Party back in New York State. This is essentially a Democratic state.
A little soul-searching now, Jim. Aren't you a little bit sorry that you didn't take that vice presidential nomination? I think it was in your grasp at one
point. I'm not a bit sorry about it. I was never interested in it. Murray, that's very sincere.
You thought they were going
to win? I wasn't interested, and it's purely on a personal basis. I frankly couldn't afford to be interested. And I'm very happy in my position. That's very sincere. There's no sour grapes about it, and I have no regrets. And a better fellow couldn't have the job. I talked to Barclay in Philadelphia, and I think I was one of three or four fellows who persuaded him to make the race. I have the greatest respect, admiration, and affection for him, and I think that the Democratic Party, not only in selecting Truman, did a good job, but they did just as good a job in selecting Alvin Barclay. He'll make a great vice president, and he's one man who has been entitled to consideration from the party for years and didn't get it.
Well, Jim, you were largely responsible for him getting that boom down there at Philadelphia.
Well,
you
I was
started that the day, the minute you got in town down there.
Well, the minute I got in town, I was for Barclay all the way, because I felt that Barclay in days that have passed, Barclay hadn't been recognized by the Democratic Party for services rendered. I don't know of any Democrat living it today who has done more unselfishly, under all kinds of conditions, fair weather and foul, for the Democratic Party. And I'm delighted in the heyday of Barclay's career to see him named as vice president and elected as vice president, and he'll make an excellent vice president.
Mr. Newman, I think, has a question.
Jim, don't you think, however, that the man is just a little old, and the position that he's in...
He doesn't act like an old fellow.
I know, but his age, what is his age?
71. 71.
72.
71, but he's a pretty vigorous fellow. He's all right. I wouldn't worry a bit about his age.
Mr. Spivak, let's keep these questions and we have
Jim,
very little time.
Jim, this is a very short one. What are we going to do about that slogan? As Maine goes, so goes the nation.
Well, I think it's been resurrected as a result of what happened. You see, the Republicans, when they won Maine this time, they started bragging about what happened. But as Maine goes, so goes Vermont. That still holds. That's
short.
A good slogan.
Short question, Mr. Snyder.
When you got to Philadelphia, you said you were disgusted with these people who were again Truman.
And I'm still disgusted with them. I'm
the
still
mayor
disgusted.
All, mayor
I don't want to mention names, but there was no excuse in the world
for those fellows who were opposed to President Truman taking the course of action they did. He was a sitting president, a Democratic president, had taken over after President Roosevelt passed on. I think he'd done an excellent job under a situation that would have almost killed any other man. And it was an outrage for those Democratic leaders to have opposed his nomination, and the American people have given the answer.
I'm sorry, gentlemen, but that's really all we have time for. Thank you for this press conference. And right now, here's something of importance for everybody who enjoys a truly good cup of coffee.
Yes, north, south, east, or west, it's Maxwell House wherever you go. Famous for finer flavor, this delicious coffee is good to the last drop. For the best in coffee drinking pleasure, always ask for Maxwell House.
Next week's guest will be another front page figure. Now this is Ken Roberts saying goodnight for Murray Snyder, Lawrence Bivak, Cecil B. Dixon, Larry Newman, Martha Roundtree, and the Honorable James A. Farley. Meet the Press is presented to you each week by Maxwell House Coffee. Be sure to look in next week, same time, same station, for Meet the Press, brought to you by the makers of Maxwell House Coffee, the coffee that's always good to the last drop.
This is NBC Television.